You're listening to episode number 73 of The Green Elephant in the Room. Greetings, this is Eco Rico. Today we're exploring the connection between global heating and gun violence. Both temperatures and gun crimes are on the rise, and experts are saying that there's a relation. A study recently published in the Journal of the American Medical Association revealed that areas experiencing abnormally high temperatures often also report increased shootings, finding a correlation between the two phenomenons. Before we discuss the comparison between climate and gun violence, let's briefly examine the enlightening history of guns and gun regulations in the United States. From the beginning of the Republic, we have had guns and we've had gun regulations. There's a long tradition before and after the Second Amendment was ratified of restrictions and even bans on carrying weapons. There were all kinds of rules banning weapons way back then and throughout the 19th century, or the 1800s. The text of the Second Amendment is the shortest of those included in the Constitution. It is only 27 words in a single sentence. Let's read it. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Let's focus on the first part of the Second Amendment. It clearly refers to the need to maintain a well-regulated militia. And there's a lot in the text to suggest that that's really what the founders were talking about, is maintaining arms for that purpose. I looked up the definition of a militia. Every definition I found referred to a military force, like this one that says, a military force that is raised from the civil population to supplement a regular army in an emergency. The Second Amendment, when it was written, was all about public safety. The militias were not like anything that we have right now. In fact, the era was very different in so many ways. Every adult white man was required to serve in the militia for their lifetime and was required by law to own a gun and bring it from home for their military service. There was no police force. There was no U.S. Army. Militias were the public safety force for the country. To this day, other countries have a similar concept of gun ownership as we did back then. Take Switzerland. The regulations of the Swiss militia system stipulate that the soldiers keep their own personally assigned weapons at home. The universal armed militia is the primary armed force of Switzerland. The Swiss militia system is one of the cornerstones of participatory democracy in Switzerland. This principle of a citizen army was subsequently set down in the Swiss Constitution of 1798, which is just within a few years of the American Constitution. So, this is a very brief history of guns and gun regulation in America. Now, let's look at how gun laws have been interpreted by the modern U.S. Supreme Court. Some conservative justices rely on the doctrine of originalism, the idea that words in the Constitution should be interpreted as they were understood at the time. So, using the concept of originalism, the conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court argue, what the founders actually meant was the Second Amendment reflected an individual right to gun ownership for self-protection. This ruling was written by Justice Thomas, and it was by far the most sweeping, the most extreme Second Amendment ruling in the country's history. It said in effect that you cannot consider public safety when looking at a gun law. He claimed that originalism required us to look at the history and traditions from the colonial era. And as you just heard, the history they're referring to wasn't even the real history. But what it has led to is the situation where dozens and dozens of long-standing laws on firearms and public safety are at risk of being struck down by this new concept of originalism, I would argue they came up with this bizarre, almost satirical, new standard. It is genuinely forcing us to look at the values and laws from the late 1700s as we try to understand how we're going to protect ourselves now at a time of murderous assault weapons and many, many other things that they didn't have back then. It appears when temperatures sizzle, so do tempers. A new study has found that any unseasonably hot day, no matter the time of year, can lead to a rush of gun violence. A U.S. study has found a significant link between gun violence and high temperatures. With the epidemic of mass shootings plaguing us, this study throws lighter fluid on a whole horrible mass murder phenomenon. Along with everything else our warming climate is throwing at us, it's estimated that almost 8,000 excess murders in the U.S. per year are associated with hot weather. Let's call it heat rage. This information provides us with a crystal clear example of how climate change is already affecting people's health across the U.S. and the world. So, what might be driving this association between heat and gun violence? Shootings were already known to peak in summer, when people are outside more and when heat can increase aggression. Gun violence was already known to rise in the summer months, though the effect of heat on aggression was only one factor. It could be that people were more likely to get out on warmer days and have more interactions, which creates more opportunities for conflict and violence. Most likely, it's a combination of both. The research study revealed that above average temperatures at any time of the year were associated with a rise in shootings. As global heating drives temperatures up, the high risk season could be extended into the spring and autumn, and the number of summer days when the risk is highest could increase dramatically. Almost 7% of all shootings, or close to 8,000 murders, were attributed to hotter than average days. Interestingly, it's not just heat that's important, but relative heat. In the winter, there were more shootings on those days which wouldn't have been hot in the summer, but were warm for winter. The temperatures associated with increased gun violence varied considerably across cities. For example, both Seattle and Las Vegas experienced the highest elevated risk of gun violence during days when temperatures soared beyond the range of average daily temperatures. But for Seattle, that temperature was 84, or 29 degrees C, while in Las Vegas, it was 104, or 40 degrees C. Even more specifically, mass shootings never or almost never happen when it's raining outside, only when the weather is clear. Mass shooters in their twisted view of the world think to themselves, today is a good day to carry out my plan when the weather is nice, or maybe some other time when it's raining that day. Not surprisingly, mitigating the impacts of climate breakdown and helping residents adjust to rising temperatures could help curb shootings. This is especially true in black communities, where they have greater exposure to adverse environmental conditions that contribute to gun violent risk, such as abandoned buildings, liquor stores, lack of green space, and more intense urban heat islands. Strangely, this means planting trees in the neighborhood could reduce gun violence. A healthy tree canopy and other heat mitigation strategies can serve as part of a mission that's part racial justice, part climate change mitigation, and part gun violence prevention. I've always been fascinated by the correlation between the politics of gun violence and the politics of climate change. Yes, they are different, but there's some striking similarities. Climate change and guns are distinct issues, Both involve political debates and considerations regarding individual rights, public safety, economic impacts, and the appropriate role of government in addressing these challenges. Both also cause serious harm through death and injury. Both are caused by and can be controlled by humans. And both pose more dangers to children than to adults. Firearms are the leading cause of death for children and teens. Children will bear more of the burdens of a warming climate and for a much longer time than adults. They are uniquely vulnerable to the health threats posed by climate change, such as air pollution, heat stress, and infectious disease. And the worst similarity? Public inaction compounds the cost of guns and fossil fuels. Sadly, proposed solutions to the twin threats of gun violence and climate change have become mired in partisan politics. The majority of Americans want stricter gun laws and climate laws, yet both are kind of stuck, where year after year not much regulation is happening, and the problem is just getting worse. Why aren't voters standing up and demanding more accountability from our elected officials? I believe it is because of the classic divide between urban and rural voters. With guns, a lot of rural lawmakers are basically saying, we are not willing to do anything. We're going to stick with the very loose gun laws that we have in place. While in urban areas, St. Louis, Chicago, Kansas City, they are some of the most dangerous cities in terms of homicide rates in the country. With climate disasters, it's often poor areas that are being impacted the most. And in both cases, with gun and climate deaths and injuries, it is people of color that carry the greatest burden. What if we use the language of one of these public health problems to conceptualize solutions to the other? Should we ask how to mitigate the rising guns and adapt to a violent world? What would that adaptation look like? Would we all carry guns and encase our bodies in bulletproof armor so we can quickly intervene in school shootings? Would all deaths from climate-fueled disasters be identified as tragic, eliciting thoughts and prayers for survivors? As crazy as these ideas sound, I argue there's even a more outrageous response on both guns and fossil fuels: doing nothing. Over time, inaction compounds the cost of fossil fuels and guns. Some people say it's too late to fix either problem. There are already too many guns and too much CO2 in the atmosphere. To me, this position is not only morally flawed, but also irresponsible in the extreme. And even if it's too late to roll back gun violence and fossil fuel emissions, I don't want to live in a world in which we have simply given up. Today's children and future generations deserve to thrive on a sustainable planet. For this reason, I will work for change now. Here are some possible solutions to both issues. The discipline of psychology has much to offer in helping us understand and mitigate both gun violence and the climate crisis. Psychologists are uniquely positioned to resolve the debate among activists about the priority of individual versus collective action. For example, should consumers try to minimize their individual carbon footprints or hold local power companies accountable for climate action targets? Psychologists have the expertise to answer several questions relevant to guns and fossil fuels. For example, questions about guns. What's the most effective way to get gun owners to store firearms safely? Or, how can we raise our children to feel safe when they hear about school shootings? Questions about climate include, how can we maintain children's belief in a sustainable future on Earth when they experience climate-fueled disasters? Or, most importantly, how do we balance anxiety with action, including political action, to inspire hope which is the most renewable of human resources. As a side note on guns, I live in Mexico. The death rate from guns in Mexico, like the U.S., is both off the charts and tragic. Living down here, I have realized something fundamental. Mexico shares the longest border in the world with the largest drug market in the world, the United States. That means billions of dollars are flowing both ways. The true difference between the two countries and cultures is this. There are almost 65,000 gun dealerships in the U.S., which is more than supermarkets, McDonald's, and Starbucks put together. In Mexico, there is one place you can legally buy a gun. One place. It's in Mexico City, and it's run by the Mexican military. As you could imagine, it's very difficult to buy a gun in Mexico. So, where are all these deadly weapons in Mexico coming from? The billions of dollars of illegal drug money that flows south to Mexico comes back to the U.S. to buy millions of extremely lethal weapons which end up murdering many innocent people. When we hear about the astronomical number of gun deaths in America, we don't consider the carnage that is also caused in Mexico. Finally, just as with guns in the U.S., using facts and common sense is not moving the solution needle with the climate crisis either. As mentioned, something that may have a chance is using human psychological techniques. The Green Elephant has researched and assembled a comprehensive guide for acting on both climate and the ecological crisis. This guide offers each of us hundreds of varied and doable solutions and actions we can take in the face of the overwhelming challenges confronting our country and the planet. It's called A Call to Act, and you can access it by the link in the show notes. That link will take you to one small section of A Call to Act, entitled Human Psychology, Climate, and the Environment. What can psychology contribute to the climate fight? In the section on psychology and climate, I counted 59 clear and accessible psychological elements for using our attitudes and feelings as the most effective tool in our environmental arsenal. As I tell my students, as big as the global environmental issues are, impacting virtually every living creature on the planet, the real solution relies on that small bit of gray matter between our ears. If you are truly serious about this issue and the future of life as we know it on Earth, please check out this resource. I guarantee you will find it genuinely inspirational.